Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora tātou, namahi nui kia koutou. A warm welcome to Cab On Air, a program brought to you by Citizens Advice Bureau, where we talk about your rights and where and how you can get help to support you and your whānau. Our focus is on some of the hot topics we see at CAB, and we invite other community organisations to join us and share information about their services as well.
Morena. Ko Ronnie Aho. I'm your host for today, along with Tom, our technical producer. Today, Tom and I are out in the field to talk with Phil Bagshaw, the inspiration and main impetus behind the Canterbury Charity Hospital. Today, Phil will tell us all about the history and development of the wonderful service provided by the Charity Hospital for patients who can't access public hospital care and can't afford private care. So thanks for allowing us to come today, Phil, and thank you for the tour around. It's absolutely amazing. So it's been obviously a first time for us. And I don't think we're exaggerating when we say how impressed we are with what you're doing here.
Thank you.
So Phil, perhaps you could just briefly tell us about your professional background, because I know how considerable it is.
well, it's a fairly long story, but I trained at the Royal Free Hospital, London University, and went on to do further training in Leicester. And when I finished my standard surgical training, it was what back then, probably still is, a routine that you would spend 3 years overseas doing some sort of project. So Peter Bell sent me here to look at the cause of peptic ulcer disease. It was an interest of mine, actually. So I was quite pleased to come here. And in fact, New Zealand did quite a lot of work in mucology at that stage. And so I worked with a very well-known and lovely biochemist called David Munster, and we thought we were going to solve the problem in 3 years, and we were then going to go home. Two things didn't happen, though. Firstly, after 30 months, they offered me a permanent job,
right,
and the family didn't want to move, so I took it. And secondly, we went on and worked on the issue for 7 years, only to be gazumped by an Australian pair who found the bacterium that actually caused the disease. Yes, Dave and I always have it swear under our breaths when we think of all the effort that we took to try and solve a problem that we were going down the wrong track, really. Anyway, all that time and since, I always worked as an academic surgeon, University of Otago, Christchurch. Took on a host of professional responsibility positions with the Gastro Society, with the College of Surgeons, with the Council of Medical Colleges, with the District Health Board. It's a sort of tiring list, really. But
exhausting list by the sounds of it,
yeah,
reading your CV. So what was the main motivation then of making the switch from all of these roles that you obviously had held, and obviously in leadership positions in medicine around the country? What was the inspiration for the Christchurch Charity Hospital?
Well, it really goes back to the fact that in the 80s, hospital care here was very good. It ran very efficiently. If you needed care, you would be seen and you would be put on a list, and ultimately you would be treated. And all of that changed in the late 1980s. Basically, it was the progression of neoliberalism, and it ruined things right from the start. And it was very clear to me early in the 1990s what was going to happen to our hospital system. One of the reasons for taking many of the professional roles I did was to try and get the profession to oppose those things. We did to a certain extent, but really things carried on. It was I was speaking on behalf of the New Zealand branch of the College of Surgeons at a conference in Australia, and an old chap started to speak there called Bob Birrell, and I was a bit jet lagged, and I thought I'd just close my eyes and have a little rest. I get ready to give my speech, and then this guy gave the best speech I've ever heard, explaining how things were deteriorating in Australia and New Zealand, and said, if things carry on like this, in no time at all, there'll be charity hospitals. So I came back, I shared that thought with three other people who all said to me, yeah, we agree, that's probably what's needed. So that was actually the stimulus that started the charity hospital here. It started off very slowly, but basically that's where it came from.
Right. So who else got involved in those early days with you?
There were three other people. It was my dear wife, Susan, who's borne a whole load of responsibility for many years. There was a colleague called Randall Allardyce, who was a scientist that I was working with at the time. And then there was a solicitor called Brian Stokes. And without Brian Stokes, there would never have been a charity hospital. Brian was well-connected and completely right behind the whole project and just helped us in so many ways.
Right. So you had a lot of skill sets
we did.
At work. But yeah. It's still, despite that, that's an incredibly ambitious undertaking to actually begin a hospital.
Well, we're nothing if not determined.
Yeah, obviously. Well, we can see the impact and the after effects of that determination. So can you just take us through and give us a bit of an overview of the development of the hospital and since its inception in, what, 2003?
2003 was, yes, the thought.
Yep.
Then we started collecting money and we started working on the mobile surgical bus. Stuart Gowland was a very good friend of ours, and Stuart was the instigator of the mobile surgical bus, and he said to me that, well, you know, you may as well start doing it on the bus when it's in town. Well, and that was about, you know, every once a month. He said, of course, it is a government project, and so I will have to charge you for this. Mm-hmm. I got a bill for $1. And I never remember having paid it.
You won't be allowed to leave the country.
No, probably not. But it used to be pulled up at one of the little hospitals and so that people could, you know, change and so on. We started doing hernias and veins and that sort of thing. And basically what we did there is we proved that the concept would work.
Right.
The patients would turn up. The surgeons, the nurses, and everybody else would turn up, and it would work. And so it really was a good way of testing the whole thing out.
Right.
Yeah. We then bought one house here. And in fact, Brian Stokes bought a gentleman around. We didn't have the money to pay for it. And the chap was called Ron Ball, again, who has been a very important person in this project. Ron Ball said, what do you need? And I said, $280,000. And he wrote me a check. And in fact, Ron went on to support us in that many ways and very quiet ways. And so he was another person for whom, without whom there wouldn't have been a charity hospital.
So there's obviously a great deal of faith in the concept of what you were trying to do and lots of people behind the scenes willing to support your mission.
Yes, I think.
And your vision.
I mean, we espoused the fact that we were going to be a charity hospital under all circumstances, that we were going to only raise money from the public. We would never take government money. We would never do anything for profit or cost. And I think people appreciated that. In fact, if you speak to people now and you say, why do you continue to support the charity hospital, they say, well, the doctors and nurses give their time for nothing and so on.
This is our way of supporting.
Yeah, yeah. We've got to do something.
Yeah. So where are things up to at the moment in terms of your developments?
We keep on developing, really. We bought another house at the time of the earthquakes, where we started counselling people in large numbers. And then with Warner Major's help, we bought some more houses. We joined them all together to produce a sort of surgical complex at one end of the building. And at the other end, we developed an endoscopy unit and then went on and developed a large dental unit as well.
Right.
So we now have 6.5 properties, and which we are now developing along those lines, basically.
Right. So that is a huge development, really, over the last 2 decades, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yes. It's and it continues to grow, I'm sure it will.
Yeah. So once you've got your new building in place, you've still got plans to continue?
Oh, we certainly have.
Just as, yeah.
Well, we are very concerned about the epidemic of bowel cancer in people under 50. It's not just Canterbury, it's not just New Zealand. It's every Western country in which people have looked. And we don't know why, but we do know that they're getting bowel cancer at a very early age, and that by the time they present, it's very late. So we need to start screening, and the idea of the ministry to drop the screening from starting at 60 to 58 will have no impact whatever. We've looked at all of this, we've modelled this with experts, and the best and most practical way of addressing this would be to start doing flexible sigmoid endoscopies on everybody at the time of their 45th birthday.
Wow.
And that will A, have, or should have, the biggest impact on mortality, and it will have be the probably the cheapest way it can possibly be done. It's not perfect, but when it comes to screening, perfect is the enemy of good. What you need is something that can be done on large numbers of people with a high degree of specificity, and not having an enormous or unburdening cost. And you have to balance all of those factors. And we have, and certainly getting nurses to do a flexible sigmoidoscopy on everybody on or about their 45th birthday will have the biggest impact.
So you've certainly made a start.
Yes. So the new building will have facilities for training them, but it will also be a general facility for education of the public and for use by community groups.
So is this a message that you're able to actually, that the government is hearing? I mean, there's so much science around what you're talking about now, and research that shows that what is likely to happen and ways of perhaps mitigating.
I don't think the government listens to much of what we've got to say, to be honest. I mean, our message to the government is much wider. Mm. It's basically that neoliberalism has failed in health and education. I can't speak in other fields, but I can in both of those.
Mm.
And the philosophy that both of these are too expensive is completely wrong. Massive studies from Europe have shown that investing in health and education is the best way you can spend your money. It produces the biggest returns.
Mm.
And we wish, it would be the happiest day of my life if I could see the philosophy changed and government start to invest again in the public and in its health and in its education, and to hang a sign on the door that says no longer needed public hospital that way.
Mm.
I think that would be the happiest day of my life. Really.
I think it might be the happiest day of a lot of people's lives, actually.
Yeah, I think it would.
Coming back to something a little bit different, you talked a lot about funding, and clearly you have ambitious plans to continue that work, and that all takes a lot of money. There are lots of very, very generous people donating. How else do you go about raising funds?
Well, we speak to community groups a lot. I mean, I suppose these days I probably do one a month or one every other month. At one time I was doing one every other week. And we tell them what we're doing and how we're doing it. That brings in some money. We have fundraising events and so on. They bring in some money. About 90% of the money now come from bequests. A lot of people leave us their homes and their possessions in their wills, and that would be our biggest source of income. But every year, the Canterbury public gives us the money we need. We need about 1.4 million a year to keep the doors open. Every year they come up trumps for us, and we stick to rigidly to the vision statement that we put out at the beginning. And I honestly believe as long as we do, they will support us. Pressure comes on periodically of why don't you take a bit of government money? You could charge for some of your services. We've never done any of that sort of thing. And I truly believe if we don't, they'll stick with us.
I think that's absolutely admirable. And I guess another source of funding per se is your staffing, because I know that all your staff give their services, you know, all the doctors and nurses who work with you give their time.
Well, we have a skeleton staff. We have to have a skeleton staff of people who take responsibility, a senior nurse in each department and so on. They have to be here whenever.
You do. You need that stability, don't you?
So that has to be the case. But all the rest, all the nurses, all the doctors, all the administration staff, a team of gardeners, they're incredible. One of them has now a door into the back of the hospital so that he can look after the garden at the weekends as well as during the week. I mean, people are dedicated to helping us, and we pamper them. We look after them. They're well fed. They know we like each other.
You like each other, and they know that they're doing something that's an extraordinarily worthwhile as well.
Yes.
And making a huge difference to people.
Yes.
Yeah. So how many would you say you know, people who gave their time? I know you've got volunteers, and then, of course, you've got all your specialist surgeons and doctors and so on. How many would you have giving their time, or is it a variable number depending on where the need is?
Well, it's approximately 300 at any time.
Right.
It varies a bit from year to year. One thing that I think I should explain is that we do have certain areas that we focus on,
right.
But what the public hospital doesn't do each year is different.
Yeah.
No question about that. In fact, sometimes it varies quite widely. And what we do is we try to fill the gap. You see, many years ago, the public and the private met. There was no sort of gap between them. The two have been moving slowly apart, and patients sort of fall through the gap
right.
that develops between them. We try to fill the gap and not to extend at all into either of those territories. But that means that we have to be aware of what the public's doing. When we started here, they weren't doing hernias very much, so I did hundreds of hernias. They then got back into hernias. So we moved out of hernias, we moved into another area. We now do a lot of gynae surgery that they don't do, for example. So we try to cover the areas that they don't.
So you have to be pretty nimble in your responsiveness need. And well, that creates a whole other layer of complex work arrangements for you too, doesn't it?
It does,
although
the staff here are very good at that sort of organisational thing. I mean, after the earthquakes, in 3 days, we had a full functioning system of counselling going on. And in no time at all, they had over 50 counsellors working out of this establishment. So they're very good at responding quickly to changing circumstances. They've been doing it for over 20 years.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the different kinds of clinical services that you...
Well, at the present time, we do general surgery. A lot of it's laparoscopic, in fact. Gynae surgery. Non-urgent gynae surgery, not a lot done in the public system, I'm afraid. So we do quite a lot of that. We've now taken on a lot of the endoscopy. Endoscopy is a very big part of our service.
And there's huge need for that from what you've said.
There is indeed. And the other area that we do a lot of is dental. We not only do dentistry, we do dental surgery, and we're well equipped for doing that. Mm. We're blessed with having a lot of dentists who will take on difficult patients. We take a lot of people from the City Mission, for example, at times, and some of the work's quite challenging. But we have a lot of dentists who were very willing to give their spare time to fill that gap.
Well, that's incredible. How do people become eligible for your services?
Well, it varies with service, but as a rule, it means that you've gone to your GP who said you need a certain procedure, and they then look on their PC, they have a program that tells them what the public's doing at any time. Health Pathways, it's called. And if Health Pathways says, yes, they're accepting referrals in that area, then they get sent to the public. If it says, no, we're not doing that right now, the options for the public, for that person, is either to go private or to go to the charity hospital. So the GP then should determine if they can't afford to pay that they're referred to us. So that's the flow for most things. For dentistry, it's somewhat different. For dentistry, it means that because you get a community services card, which gives you a certain amount of work, but if you still have a lot left to be done, then you're referred here and we'll do our best to render you dentally fit.
Right. So people can't self-refer. They do need, there needs to be a referral process of some kind.
Yes. At the time of the earthquakes, they could self-refer for counselling, but at other times, you have to go through a health practitioner. Mm. Yes.
You're seeing the need growing?
Oh, the need grows all the time. Mm. At first, we used to think we covered about a third of it. I don't know whether we cover anything like that now. We do as much as we can within the resources at our disposal, but there is no question the need is growing very rapidly.
Yeah, I'm just sort of wondering, when you reflect, what do you see as your greatest challenges?
The challenge is always really to try and meet as much of the need as we possibly can. I mean, you know, we've seen tens of thousands of people, and we've tried to meet all of the needs, but at the moment, our big focus is on bowel cancer. We have done a lot of research in that area, a lot of original research, and we're hoping that we can make a big contribution by teaching nurses to do flexible sigmoidoscopy. There will be opposition to that. There will be opposition to that in nursing. There will be opposition to that amongst some of the medical people. There will be opposition, no doubt, in the ministry, which seem to oppose everything we try to do, but that we never let those things get in the way.
But that's ironic, really, when you're actually doing such an incredible job in the community.
Well, the one thing we are is determined.
Yep, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And that's 20 years of your last 20 years of your life, Phil. And those of your colleagues and other members of the trust.
Yes.
Yeah, and Sue.
And my dear lady wife.
And your dear lady
who
wife
puts
as well.
Up with it. Yes.
Who's got her own mission as well. Yeah. So, what are you most happy about? What's giving you the most satisfaction, sense of accomplishment?
Oh, I think knowing that there have been tens of thousands of people who just wouldn't have got treatment. I think that's the biggest satisfaction. I mean.
That's a pretty big one.
That's a fairly
I don't think many people can say that.
That's a fairly big one, yeah. Yes. I think the fact that we've stuck to the vision statement, I think a lot of people at first don't understand its significance, but later on realise how important that's been, really. And I think the other one is the confidence that we have in the people of Canterbury, that that they have supported us, and that I think as long as we remain faithful to what we've said, they will do so. I mean, I think I get great solace in all of those things. Stick to the course.
Exactly. Well, thanks, Phil. Just before we do finish, how can we help?
Oh, get the message out. We're trying to help other places. Wellington are trying at the moment to build a charity hospital. They've had a very generous donation, which is going to be very great help to them. They'll need help, and I think if you can get the word out that they'll need help like we have, I think that would be a great thing for you to do.
Okay, great. So thanks, Phil. It's just been great to talk to you today. It's actually been incredibly inspiring for both of us, and hopefully for listeners as well when they hear you talking. I think that the the contribution that the charity hospital makes for others who would be unable otherwise to access important health services is just so laudable. So thanks for having us here and showing us around today. It just fills me with hope. You see things like this happening. It's great.
Thank you for coming.
So thank you. So Phil's given us a wonderful insight into the huge contribution that the charity hospital makes in our community. He outlined the history and development of the hospital, the purpose and the impetus behind its creation, and described the huge range of services it offers, how it works, including the staffing and how people can access the services. Phil also talked about that crucial aspect of funding and how generous the community has been in Christchurch in Canterbury, and talked a little bit about some of the challenges and satisfactions that running such a huge enterprise involves. So, warmest thanks to our inspiring and indefatigable guest, Phil Bagshaw, today. And finally, thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, mā te wā.
Just a reminder that this show can be found as a podcast. Just go to the Plains FM website and look for Cab on Air. In the meantime, if you're looking for information on any topic, but especially if they relate to your rights in New Zealand, you can contact us at CAB in person, by phone, emails, and through our website, and a lot of other ways as well, I think. We provide verifiable, accurate, and confidential information to help you understand what your next steps should be. So tune in next month when we'll highlight another organisation providing information and support within our community. Kia ora, thank you for listening. Until next time, mā te wā.